Welcome to the Digital Show Podcast. Every week, your hosts Kevin Werbach, Kartik Osanagar, and Lauren Feldman will talk with business leaders, entrepreneurs, policymakers, and experts about how technology is changing our world. From software to the internet to mobile, we explore the digital issues facing you and your organization. Here's this week's host.
I'm your host this week, Kevin Werbach. I teach legal studies and business ethics and various and sundry other things here at the Wharton School. First off, I will be joined by Aaron Griffith from Fortune Magazine for our regular weekly tech news update. With that, let me welcome my first guest, Aaron Griffith, who's a writer from Fortune, has been on with us several times, and we're delighted that she's back for the tech news update this week. So, Aaron, thank you for coming on the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this last week or so was earnings season for a bunch of tech companies, and one of the companies that just reported last week was Facebook, and you did a piece talking about how not only did they have a really good quarter, but this seems to be a trend. So how is Facebook seemingly killing it now for such an extended period of time?
I was observing that their earnings calls lately have kind of felt like victory laps almost. The questions from analysts have, really aren't that critical anymore. They're basically just like excited about what's going to what's coming in the future for Facebook. And I think there's a lot of reasons behind that. The main one, though, is that Facebook has just really executed really, really well for the 3 years that it's been public. And so, when they consistently deliver solid growth and shows no signs of really slowing and solid profits, investors have no choice but to continue to trust them to do that. And, that's part of that is because Facebook, when they went public, their IPO was a pretty ugly mess, and they were on the defensive right away. A lot of people were concerned that they couldn't make money on mobile, and within a couple of years, they proved that they can. Now the vast majority of their money comes from mobile, and desktop revenue is actually declining. So, when investors ask them for something, they actually deliver it, which is pretty impressive. And so investors continue to reward it.
So let's talk about some of the things that Facebook actually has done. You mentioned one, which is the shift to mobile. And this is a pretty remarkable one because obviously there's been this great transformation to a mobile-first world ever since the rise of the release of the iPhone in 2007. And even though everyone saw this coming, or everyone at least was reading about and acknowledging that it was coming, so many companies have missed it and haven't been able to make that pivot. So how is it that Facebook, how have they been able to flip that around to the point where, based on their latest numbers, I think you mentioned they have more people regularly visiting Facebook via mobile than the desktop?
Oh, they definitely have more people, using it on mobile, and they saw that trend a long time ago. But the most important part, though, is that the vast majority of their revenue now comes from mobile. And I think, their growth in mobile advertising revenue has outpaced the entire industry's shift of ad spending from desktop to mobile. So eventually, they're going to have to wait for the rest of the world to catch up and start spending more money on mobile. But the shift in user behavior has happened very quickly, and they had some missteps early on. They thought that the mobile website was going to be dominant, and so they put a lot of resources into an HTML5 website, and right. Turned out people actually really did want to use the app. And so then they went full force into that, and fortunately they didn't fall too far behind to actually make it work. And in places where they're weak, they bought some companies. They made some really smart acquisitions. They don't have a lot of people using their Messenger app overseas, so they bought WhatsApp, which basically dominates that market. They noticed that people were kind of changing their photo sharing habits and using different apps, and so they bought Instagram. They tried to also buy Snapchat, and that didn't work out. So, they've gotten a stronghold or a foothold at least in other areas where they're weak, but also their app, it just so happens that their advertising product translated really well to mobile because their app is such an exact replica of their desktop behavior.
All right, so we've got to wrap up because we're just about out of time. Aaron, always delightful to have you on the show. Look forward to doing it again and talking about some other stuff then.
Great. All right, thanks.
I'm happy to welcome to the show Jeremy Miller. He is director of quantitative analysis at DFC Intelligence, where he's worked since 2008, leading development of web-based data analysis and integration terms, tools, and services. So, Jeremy, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, Kevin. Glad to be here.
So, you know, as I said, you guys look at trends in these markets. I think a lot of people that I talk to who are not familiar with the games industry see this thing coming across the ticker that the company making Candy Crush gets bought for $6 billion and say, $6 billion for Candy Crush?
Yeah, that was kind of a surprise. Everyone in the industry basically said, what? No one was expecting it. And one thing that Activision has been good about over the years is for any type of financial transaction, acquisition, or anything that they do, they've been pretty tight-lipped about it and have been very good about controlling leaks. And they're very serious about it. Back when they bought, or when they did that whole merger activity with Blizzard, essentially, I knew many people at the time who worked at Blizzard or at Activision had no idea that was happening until they saw the news about it and kind of spit out their coffee. So Activision's very good about that. And the media reaction was, what? Exactly the same thing. Why would they buy King? And so then everyone started immediately running through the numbers and kind of coming up with a very similar analysis across the board. And initially, the $5.9 billion seems like that may be the best possible outcome for the King shareholders, simply because where is King going? It's not that Candy Crush is plummeting. It didn't have this very rapid drop like Zynga did after its IPO. I think at the time the deal was announced, they were still under the IPO price of $22.50 from last year, but they were nowhere near as far down as where Zynga went, a year after its IPO. But the problem is, where would Candy Crush go? And, they were announcing some slightly more profitability from their paying users, but their total user base was dropping. It wasn't like it was collapsing, but it was just trending downward. And if your core product is slightly trending downward and your other products are a fraction of the size of your core product, then there's not a lot of long-term upside. So everyone, for a while with King, has just been waiting, okay, when's the bottom going to drop out? Is Candy Crush going to collapse the way Zynga essentially did? And the near-term...
And Angry Birds, Rovio seems to be.
Yeah, exactly, because that was a fad that wore itself out. And Zynga was kind of a fad that wore itself out, and Zynga has never been able to recover since. With Candy Crush, it's still kind of riding, not at its peak, but still pretty up, pretty high. It's big, it's up there. And, it has a lot of revenues, but it's just not trending upwards. So what happens? Is it going to fall out of the sky? What's going to happen? So no one really knew. But then along comes Activision and does this deal. And I think realistically, if you're a King shareholder, this has got to be a big sigh of a relief, because at least you're getting a premium for where your holding is now. And it's hard to predict that suddenly King's going to have another mega hit. And that's one of the key issues in mobile for some of these very large players, and which is similar to what happened with Zynga. How do you have a massive hit after a massive hit? You mentioned, how does Angry Birds or Rovio have another franchise that's not Angry Birds that gets that big when you've got sequel after sequel and people just stop consuming, stop paying money? And how much Angry Birds merchandise can they push?
Right.
So King's got that long-term problem.
Yeah, no, if I could just interrupt you there, it is what's striking to me about that market. I want to get to Activision and what the merger might mean potentially in a minute, but just staying on the mobile games, what's striking is simultaneously just how big some of these hits have been so fast. The ones you mentioned, we're talking about $1 billion a year or more franchises with very healthy profit margins in just a short period of time, and yet how consistently the pattern has been this huge upswing. And then despite the fact that every one of these companies has said, oh, no, we're not going to go down this road of just having one big hit. We've got all this analytics. We've got all this player data. We know exactly what we're doing. We're going to turn this into more hits. So far, no one's been able to break that curse. So what is it about this market that tends to lead it to that in that direction?
Well, you're exactly right. No one's really been able to replicate capturing lightning in a bottle, and that's exactly what Candy Crush is, or Supercell's Clash of Clans is, or the Puzzles and Dragons is. All these games are just, they're lightning in a bottle. And if you think about it from, you know, teaching business school 101 strategy class to first year students, you're talking about basic strategy and the network effect. You know, this is the best player. You know, you've got a monopoly on this kind of gameplay, and you maybe you're not the only one, but your brand gets, it just catches fire and kind of out of luck.
So we're going to have to wrap up, unfortunately. I'm sorry to cut you off, but appreciate the perspective. And it's been great talking to you about all these developments. We'll see, I guess, if there are some other big deals in the games industry. Love to have you back on the show again. So Jeremy Miller from DFC Intelligence, appreciate having you with us.
Thanks, Kevin.
Absolutely. My next guest is Jonathan Chaplin, who covers the industries that give you all of that delicious connectivity. He's a telecom analyst at New Street Research. Before that, he was at Credit Suisse, been recognized through many awards as one of the top analysts in telecom on the street. And so, Jonathan, I'm glad to have you with us on the show.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm glad to be here.
So why don't we start, give us a pulse of the broadband market from your standpoint in the U.S. right now. You know, what's the market look like at this point? How healthy is it from an investor standpoint?
So I think you can look at it two ways, Kevin. How healthy is it from an investor standpoint, and how healthy is it from a consumer standpoint? The answer might be a little bit different in each case. So sort of in broad brush strokes, we're just a hair under 80% penetration of households in the U.S. And in almost all cases, in all but very few cases, there are two pipes going into the home, one owned by the cable company, one owned by the telecom company. In about 86% of the country, the cable company has a far better pipe. So they're in 86% of the country, they're competing against some form of old copper plant owned by the telecom company, and they can offer much, much more capacity. In just 16% of the country, they're competing against a fiber offering. Most of those are old Verizon markets where they deployed Fios. So as we look at that from the perspective of investors in cable companies, it's fantastic. You've got this product with tremendous utility, and the utility of the product is rising every day as more and more happens over the internet, particularly as people start to consume more and more video over the internet. And they've got a virtual monopoly in 86% of the country. That's a fantastic market dynamic to be operating in.
Yeah, sounds good. What's the problem?
From a consumer perspective, maybe not so great. Maybe it'd be better to have two pipes going into the home. As a consequence of the AT&T DirecTV deal, AT&T's been required to upgrade another 12 million homes. Google is doing their best to find a way to make fiber deployment more economic so that they can deploy fiber in more homes. But even if you put all of those efforts together, we're probably, under current circumstances, not likely to end up with two really competitive providers in more than about a third of the country.
So it's really a kind of classic oligopoly situation for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I mean, in its best case, it's an oligopoly somewhere between 86% of the time and 70% of the time, it's a monopoly, really.
So I want to ask you about the cable issues and the video issues, but first let me just stick on this a little bit. So, you know, Google has gotten a lot of attention for what they're doing with their fiber service rolling out in different markets, and there are a few other interesting players. Are they having any impact on the businesses or the practices of the dominant companies?
Yes and no. So there has been a tremendous amount of press about Google Fiber, and when they initially launched a couple of years ago, it had a huge impact on the anxiety of the industry and investors But it, you know, the moment they're only at about 600,000 homes, Kevin. So it's a tiny fraction of the 100 or so 30 million homes in the country that are able to get Google Fiber. The direct impact has been small. Google had talked about looking at another 33 cities that they could roll fiber into, and I think they've so far announced an additional 3. So the fundamental problem, I think, is it's really difficult to make the investment case for a fiber overbuilder with broadband prices being where they are.
Well, unfortunately, we got to stop as we're out of time. Jonathan Chaplin from New Street Research, delightful to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Kevin.
So for my last guest, pleased to welcome Priya Kumar, who is a research analyst with the Ranking Digital Rights Project, which is a fascinating project that just has launched. And I was in some of the early meetings a couple of years ago when the project was first getting off the ground. And so it's exciting to see it come to fruition. Priya, I'm delighted that you can be with us on the show.
Thanks, Kevin, so much for having me. And I'm glad that you are able to see what has come out of those early conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. So give us the context. So what's the Ranking Digital Rights Project? And what was the rationale for having this kind of index?
Absolutely. So we just launched our 2015 Corporate Accountability Index last week, in which we ranked 16 of the world's largest internet and telecommunications companies on their respect for users' free expression and privacy. And before we delve into the index and what we found, I think it'll be good to just lay the groundwork for what we mean by digital rights. You know, why is an index like this needed? And I think it's, you know, we talk a lot about how digital technology gives people a voice, it lets people connect with others, and it definitely does. But so many of our online interactions happen in spaces that are controlled by companies. So, you know, you post tweets on Twitter, you send email through Gmail or Yahoo Mail, you send text messages through your local telco provider. And we have to make sure that these global networks, these technologies that we use every day as part of our daily life, align with human rights, that using these tools doesn't mean that people's voices or content gets censored and restricted, or that their personal user data gets shared with the governments or with other organizations.
Can you give some flavor about what some of the findings were of the index that you've released so far?
Absolutely. So we'll get to the good stuff. the big headline coming out of this index was really that there are no winners. You know, even the companies in the lead are falling short. So the highest scoring company overall got a 65%, which I'm sure if we were in one of your classes, Kevin, that would be a D. So not the best performance. But the way we view this is, you know, this index, this evaluation is kind of the diagnostic test. So it's what you take when you walk into the classroom to get a sense for where you are. And our goal now is that now that we have all of this information, we have information that allows people to compare how companies performed on specific indicators or specific aspects, that we can really now move forward and use this as a starting point to talk about how can companies better address these concerns? You know, what can they be doing? And also, what else needs to change? So in some cases, what laws have to change in order for companies to do well? So, I mean, looking overall, out of the 16 companies, only 6 companies scored at least 50% or mm-hmm. higher. And 9 companies in the index scored at least 30%, which we viewed as the minimum threshold. You know, it showed that they are doing something to try and respect users' rights. But on the flip side, 7 companies, which is nearly half in the index, only scored between 13 and 22% overall, which shows a serious deficit when it comes to respecting users' rights and shows that there's a lot of work to be done moving forward.
But I guess that begs the question, though, where you set the bar, right? Because I would assume some of those companies would say you're making completely unrealistic demands about or expectations about what a company might do. Sure, in theory, one could imagine a company that, you know, is extraordinarily protective about privacy, but that's just not realistic, and no one else does that. So how do you assess that that's the right level to set?
And that's a really good point. And I think, you know, that's part of where we really want for this to be a conversation starter. So we are definitely not saying these are the end all be all. This is the way it has to be. And we started hearing that from companies themselves. You know, we've laid out a set of criteria around these topics of freedom of expression and privacy. And in some cases, there were companies said, we understand where you're coming from, but we, you know, we don't think that X, Y, or Z would necessarily be the best approach. And our response is, you know, we're hoping now that all, now that the index is up and out there, that we can sit down and have conversations around, you know, well, for example, one of the areas of improvement across the board is when it comes to grievance or remedy. So, for example, if you're a user of one of these tools and you feel like the company's actions have violated your rights, what sorts of mechanisms exist for you to convey that to the company and to seek some kind of grievance or redress?
I am glad to see that this is coming to fruition, and Priya, I really appreciate you joining us on the show to talk about it.
No, thank you so much. Thanks for letting me help help join in the conversation.
Absolutely. And the website is rankingdigitalrights.org?
Yep.
That's right.
Rankingdigitalrights.org.
Terrific. Thanks for joining us on the show.
This has been the Digital Show Podcast. To find out more about the Digital Show, visit our site at digitalshow111.com or follow us on Twitter at @digitalshow111. We'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening.